You are listening to the Sarah Fader podcast. This is What Anxiety Feels Like. And I'm here with Garrett Kennedy, the author of Didn't We Almost Have It All? Of course. Didn't We Almost Have It All? In defense of Whitney Houston. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So Garrick is an author, and of course, my brain is on such a Monday schedule. How would you describe yourself?
How would I describe myself? Well, you know, my background is in music journalism. I've been doing that for over a decade now, much longer. With this book is my second book. I wrote a book on NWA and the rise of gangster rap like 5 or 6 years ago.
I love NWA.
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
They're
so awesome. So it makes me excited to hear anybody that.
Yes, they're amazing. And I mean, you're talking to a child of the 80s and 90s. So I'm all about old school hip hop.
Right. Exactly.
Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, all the good people. Yes.
Yes. That was just straight ahead music journalism, which is my roots. But I really wanted to do a book rooted in cultural criticism. Because I think the ways in which we consumed Whitney and the ways in which we did not consider her for all she was and all she was not is a great part of why we have the relationship that we have with her, right? So there's a mix of sadness and guilt and grief that I see the way it shows up in how there is sort of this really limited conversation around her, where it's either we're talking about the tragedies or, you know, we're just talking about the Star Spangled Banner. And we're not really talking about the totality of who she was.
Absolutely. And I think it's a disservice because she was a complex human being. And yeah. I think that in our society, we do trivialize mental health as it relates to artists. I think, you know, we see that with Britney Spears. We see that, you know, it's really sad because Whitney Houston went through a lot of struggles. And I think,
yes,
you know, so tell us about sort of her rise to fame.
You know, I mean, the thing with Whitney that I feel like everyone has such a good handle on is that part right there. It's right. The rise. Everyone remembers, you know, those record-breaking singles, you know, 7 back-to-back number ones. People remember The Bodyguard and how that was this huge sensation because of I Will Always Love You in that particular record. People recall, of course, what she did at the Super Bowl during the Gulf War and, you know, doing the national anthem and that becoming this big rallying moment for not just America, but for the entire world that was looking at, you know, this war that was happening. And because she was a part of all of those moments, it really did allow her to become one of the biggest stars on the planet for much of the late 80s and, you know, early 90s as she was, you know, moving between, you know, Hollywood and her own recording career. But there were these other layers to the story as well. Some of those layers, of course, I think, you know, we've talked so much about how the music was perceived, how she was perceived, this idea around blackness and that she wasn't black enough because of the music, feeling like it wasn't, you know, R&B enough, wasn't soul enough, wasn't, you know, I think these expectations that were placed on her because she was, you know, this black woman from, you know, Newark, from the church. You know, her mom, Sissy, was this formidable soul singer, gospel singer, and obviously, you know, an icon in her own right. But I do think a lot of what then happened was people projected their own expectations of who she should be based off of that lineage, based off being, you know, her and Dionne Warwick being related. You know, I think there was this idea that Whitney Houston was going to be someone else, but I wanted to push back on that because I believe that the Whitney that we got was the only Whitney that we could have received, given all of that, given sort of the family lineage, given sort of the way in which, you know, stars were created in the 80s. I mean, that's just, you know, there's this thing that, you know, we see so much of, which is this idea that she had no autonomy over her own career. She had no agency in how she was able to move through the industry. And I always resented that kind of conversation because it feels like it really, it didn't allow her to sort of have the voice that we all knew that she had, but it did this other thing, which is like, and we've seen it so much, you know, you mentioned Britney Spears, where it's this thing that we often do with women in particular of, you know, well, you're not in control. There's some man that's like making all of these decisions. And because, you know, she signed to a label and the man that she signed with is a very famous, you know, record producer, and he was somebody who he wanted to create stars. But that is the job. That is how the industry has always
worked. So who is this man? Tell us about this man.
So we're talking about Clive Davis, and, you know, very, you know, legendary record executive. And I believe that the idea that, you know, she was a complete creation of his, you know, while some of it is true, a lot of it is, you know, not true in a sense. Like, you know, she still has the voice. She's still choosing how she wants to sing these songs. She's still choosing whether or not she wants to sing these songs. But because she wasn't writing them, because she wasn't producing them in this really traditional way, and he was picking them and asking her, you know, do you like these songs? I think these should work for the album. These are the producers I think should work for the album, which is what a lot of record executives do with their
artists. Thinking about like Ellie Reed. That type of personality.
It's par for the course of the industry. It's just how the music industry works. But I think this idea that because she, you know, had this big voice and she wasn't a songwriter and she wasn't a producer, it was very easy to create this story of, oh, you know, it was all created for her.
So you're pushing back against that narrative and you're looking at Whitney as a holistic person. Now, you did mention this sort of, they were creating or trying to put her in a box as a Black woman. So what kind of, like, what boxes were they trying to put her in terms of personality or cultural image?
I think, I don't believe it's an approximation to whiteness. I mean, to some degree there was, you know, with Clive, there is this very, you know, infamous story of, you know, when she was making the first album, he was sending songs back and saying, you know, let's kind of scrub the gospel flourishes down, let's kind of polish it down a little bit, you know, more like Barbara Streisand, less, you know, James Brown. So, you know, a lot of what she was doing, a lot of her vocal decisions are rooted in singing in the church, and that is an inherently Black vocal, and that is an inherently Black way of singing. And so when you have someone that's like, oh, polish that down, yes, that is obviously, he's making a decision because he wants this to be able to be played on adult contemporary radio, which is mostly white artists. He wants it to be played on top 40 radio, which is mostly white artists. He wants it to be able to, you know, land on MTV, which at the time was mostly white artists. I think people forget a lot of, you know, what the late 80s were, especially on MTV, which was not showing Black faces.
MTV Raps, right? Like,
no, we weren't even there yet.
We weren't even there in the 80s.
No, we weren't there yet. We had to get there, but we only got there because, you know, there's one of, when Michael Jackson had the Thriller album, you know, his record executive at the time had to threaten MTV because they wouldn't play Billie Jean, because the only Black artist they were playing was like Tina Turner because it was rock music. Right. So they didn't believe that their audience would want to see anything else. So yes, some of it was race based, but it was also this idea of, oh no, we only exist for rock. So, you know, before we can even get to an MTV Raps, we still had to have, you know, Michael break down that barrier, Janet break down that barrier, and Whitney break down those barriers. Those are the three Black artists that really helped break down that barrier, along with like Lionel Richie, but, you know, he was making pop music, but they all were, but this idea of it could really only be, you know, like hard rock in a particular sense. So like Tina Turner was really the only Black artist that was getting sort of any like airplay on MTV. So, you know, making those shifts and seeing that, that's, you know, all of these barriers that Whitney had to break. There were so many. I mean, even up to a moment like you know, being cast in The Bodyguard, and like, yes, Kevin Costner ultimately wanted the biggest singer, you know, who was a woman on the planet, because that's what the film called for.
Right.
But there was no consideration that, you know, she was also a Black woman, and it's going to be a huge deal that there's going to be an interracial relationship shown in a Hollywood film. And, you know, in retrospect, I always have this like tough, I have a tough relationship with The Bodyguard because I love it so much, but it also bothers me that there is like no acknowledgement
of the fact that she's Black. Yeah,
of the fact that she's a Black woman, yeah. Including even a scene where you were seeing them in a country music bar and she is the only Black person in the entire place.
Right, it's like, hello, can we address this issue?
Can we address this issue? And there would, and the reality is there would have been a comment. You know, there
would have been a comment.
She would have mentioned something. He would have mentioned something. Somebody else would have mentioned something. You know, there would have been something. You just don't, you don't walk in those places and you're the only one, and it's not mentioned.
Well, I don't know. Let me know what you think about this, but I feel like the way that they were behaving, it's almost like those ignorant white people that are like, I don't see color, you know? And I feel like what they, that's what they're doing by not addressing the fact that she's Black.
Yeah.
And I feel like, yeah, exactly. So it is that, as a music journalist, do you see that type of narrative? Do you see people ignoring Blackness, or, you know, trying to, in like, you know, like the I don't see color movement?
I think it's to me, it's always a lazy thing to say.
Yes.
Is good natured as I think those folks try to be when they say it. But, you know, it's a thing that, you know, one of the first interviews I did for this book, you know, months ago at this point, I had gotten this really angry DM from a woman who, you know, she starts by telling me that she's a white woman, of course, because of course they have to tell you I am. It's like, okay, yeah, sure. Okay. And she's like, I thought it was so disgusting that you were talking about race as it relates to Whitney Houston, because the world loved her. Like, she didn't experience racism at all. Everybody loved her. And like,
how the hell do you know?
No one saw her color. And I was just like, but even you even saying the words, I don't see the color, is you acknowledging the reality that oftentimes people who have Black and brown skin are met with violence because of the fact that they have Black and brown skin. So you wanting to say that is somehow supposed to make me as a Black person feel seen, despite the fact that what you were basically telling me is, oh, no. I know that typically, you know, you are met with some level of, you know, violence or antagonism on a probably frequent basis, but, you know, I don't see you at all because, you know, we're just the exact same. And it's like, it's bullshit because it's not true.
It's,
like, it just isn't true. And I think also there's ways to acknowledge systemic racism without like doing the thing where it's like, I get it, because you believe that you don't contribute to it because you don't have this hate in your heart, or you don't do things that are anti-Black or that can contribute to an idea of like perpetuating, you know, white supremacy. Like, just you saying that actually does.
Yeah,
if
it's,
I'm
so,
being honest, you know, just you saying that is contributing to that. And because I think, you know, we see so much of that, we saw so much of that with Whitney for so long, that I thought was then really interesting. At a particular point, the conversation then became, you know, you're too Black and now you're acting too ghetto, you know, and that's something that I, you know, I wanted to write about that as well, which I do think, you know, when you are spending 10, 15, 20 years having this conversation around a particular person, you don't think that does anything to their mental health?
Of course,
that does anything to, you know, how they see themselves. And what we saw with Whitney for the entirety of her career was her being really tired. Her being really tired of the way that she was being treated by the public, by the media, by even fans, honestly.
When you got that DM from that woman, and she said, I don't feel like Whitney experienced racism, how did you react?
You know, honestly, I mean, I have an entire book that goes against that very thing. So like, you can just like read the book, which is actually just what I told the woman. But also too, I think, you know, I don't really, I don't want to say I don't have space for that kind of a conversation because I've brought it up in several interviews, but I think it's such a good example of sort of the absurdity that I think, you know, people, especially when they are wanting to criticize or admonish you for what you said in a public space, like the fact that she actually thought, like, I'm going to say this, and like, what reaction did you actually think you were going to get? But also, like, what do you believe, like, you saying this somehow is going to invalidate an entire work that you haven't even engaged, which also, like, you probably aren't smart enough to engage. I mean, just to be honest, if you put into words in 2022 that Whitney Houston never experienced racism, and you truly believe that in your spirit, I don't want you to read my book anyways, because I don't actually think that you should be engaging my work, because you seem really limited in the way that you think. And as opposed to me trying to, like, educate you through this, like, you don't want to. You just want to be heard, and you want to be loud so you can be loud and wrong by yourself. You know, like, that's really kind of it.
Yeah, because there probably isn't hope in educating that person.
Like, no hope.
No hope at all. So, in the book, tell us about the ways that Whitney experiences racism within the music industry.
You know, I really do think it's, you know, and this, the thing is this, too, is I think a lot of people, they really only see racism as like, oh, well, you know, I don't see anywhere where she was called the N-word. You know, I think people really only see it in this really flat way. They don't understand, like, anti-blackness and, like, what that also contributes to. So even something as simple as, like, you know, this idea that she married this man for show is, to me, anti-black, because part of what the conversation is was, this man wasn't worthy, and the only reason that he was deemed unworthy is because he had several baby mamas, he had a couple of criminal charges. It was this idea that, like, oh, well, this person isn't good enough, and it's going to diminish this other person, despite the fact that, like, lots of people have kids by, you know, multiple people, and that doesn't make them bad people at all. It doesn't make them anything, but there's a way in which we judge black people for doing that. And we've done forever. Just the truth. And I think, you know, the idea that whenever she was trying to not code switch, because, you know, she was a celebrity who was media trained very well. So if you look at a lot of her early interviews, like, Whitney knows how to code switch. She knows how to turn on the charm and turn on this idea of who Whitney Houston should be and, like, the presentation of that. But there was also times when, you know, just Nippy comes out, and that's just like Whitney, and that's who she is. She was a girl from Newark, from the Bricks. And so, like, every now and then you would catch her not code switching. And I think people had a hard time seeing those two different people, even though they were not that different. It was just somebody who didn't care as much about being proper in the way that she spoke, or, like, you know, wasn't going to filter out a curse word, you know, or things like that. But
can you think of an interview instance in which she, you said code switch, right? Is that the
code
term
switch.
You use? Yeah. Oh, code switch. Okay. Can you think of an instance where that you can recall, like, an interview where she code switched?
I mean, I think one of the very famous ones is, you know, her and Diane Sawyer, and Diane Sawyer is holding an image of, you know, Whitney, who is thin, and, you know, it was a time of, you know, great concern, obviously, as, you know, all the conversation around her dependency on substances were, like, at that point now, a public conversation, and she was demanding Whitney to give her an explanation as to why she looks this way. And, you know, Whitney very casually, you know, slides back in her chair and is like, "Well, you tell me, Diane." You know, and then you can hear this person. Yeah. So what? She's doing. Well, what? And so, you know, and Whitney's having this moment. Like, no, you tell me. And it's a thing where you're seeing a person call somebody out. That's like, you're telling me that what I'm telling you about myself is not the truth, and you want to push back against that. So why don't you just go ahead and tell me what it is then, since you want to actually tell me to my face, you know, and there's so many moments like that, you know. There's one of my favorites is like, because she's with Oprah, it's really easy to, you know, for her to like slide sure. out of it, but for her to slide, you know, and kind of really nicely tell Oprah, you know, mind your business, you know. Or, you know, another famous one is, you know, her calling up Wendy Williams when Wendy Williams had a radio show, and you're just, you know, you got 100% nippy where, you know, this is a phoner, and she wasn't a planned guest. She called her up because she was tired of hearing all her gossip about her. Yep. And she just straight ahead gave you 1,000% nippy and was like, you know, I can come meet you where you need me to meet you at. So I think, you know, there's lots of these moments over the years. You know, I think I thought a lot about, especially some of the early 80s stuff where you could see her frustration, especially around like questions on like, well, who are you dating? And like, why won't you tell us? Or, you know, what about this music? And, you know, why isn't it, we think it should be more rooted in this. And it's like, how are you telling a person what the music should be? And she's telling you what she wants to sing.
How did the perception of her relationship with Bobby Brown impact her mental health?
Oh my gosh. I think the biggest thing with Bobby that, you know, is something that I've thought about often is how many years she spent having to defend her marriage. I can't think of any other contemporary star, celebrity, whatever you want to call, that had to defend their marriage for as long as Whitney did to the press. I've run through the list of folks who were like, who are people like in relationships and like who got the questions the way that Whitney got them, where it was like, it was everywhere. I mean, there's even like magazine covers where the TikTok of like what the bullet points are is going to be, and she's telling us why she loves Bobby, and it's just like,
that's awful.
I can't think of a person that we've did. I mean, you know, when I think about like, because I write so much in comparison to, you know, Britney Spears, because Britney to me is, you know, such a through line here. The same as like Mariah and the same as Janet. And I think these women who were, you know, highly mistreated, which is what they all share. But even with Britney, like, yeah, she was asked to sort of defend her relationship with Kevin Federline. But she also faces other thing too, which is like, there's this really famous, and hate to say it, but I believe it's Diane Sawyer, where it's like, you know, well, tell us what you did to Justin Timberlake. I mean, you must have done something. You just, I mean, he wouldn't have made that song if you didn't do something to him. Like, so tell us what you did.
Yeah, what happened? Why did Cry Me a River happen? It was obviously
Cry Me a River happen? It was obviously your fault.
Your fault, exactly.
But, you know, even that level of aggression, you know, she then didn't have to spend, as awful as that interview was, and it is awful, if you go back and watch it now, it's kind of like, oh, wow, we were really like this, you know, like we were, but like,
I need to go watch that because they've destroyed her so many times. I was thinking about Mariah Carey when you mentioned Mariah Carey, and it's so sad to me because, you know, she didn't get the privacy to deal with her bipolar disorder. They just put her on blast, and it's terrible. Right.
And, you know, I mean, the thing with Mariah is, you know, it's similar to, you know, what Whitney dealt with, you know, when those photos of, you know, the drug den, you know, quote unquote, was posted in the National Enquirer in 2006, I believe. You know, that was, her sister-in-law did that. And it was the exact same way that, you know, when Mariah was going through her stuff, that was her family. Her family was putting that in the press. And so I think of sort of that, the other side of it, like, yeah, it's already awful that you're being treated this way, but then there's also the family betrayal too that adds to it that I can't imagine what Whitney must have really felt when her sister-in-law did that. You know, at least Mariah, you know, she got to a place where she wrote that book. It's a beautiful book if you ever have a chance to read
it. I definitely need to read that.
But she writes about, you know, her siblings and how, and her mom, and how they did not have her best interest when she had, you know, an actual, you know, breakdown because she was stressed out, because she was all these things. And in reality, as she writes, was, you know, I was told that this is how I was behaving and that this was going on. When the truth of the matter is, I was stressed out and she was having a reaction like a lot of people. But, you know, if you really sit and like engage what Mariah said, I don't actually believe that she's bipolar, because I don't actually think so. I don't think that was actually a diagnosis that she was given. That was what a story was put into the media. And right. So somebody who had a challenging year, as lots of people do, and who had a crisis, and that crisis was then taken advantage of by like family who then wanted to just like throw you in a hospital and also like get a conservatorship because it would be a way to get your money. I've always really kind of thought about that moment and the unkindness around that, and the fact that, you know, she then had to be really gracious in public because she's being called XYZ things, but nobody is actually like asking her.
No, they're just assuming, and you don't know.
It's just an assumption.
Yeah, you don't know what's going on in someone's life or in their mental health. And I think, you know, you speak to that a lot in the book. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because I was thinking about Bobby Christina.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, if Whitney were alive today, what do you think her feeling on Bobby Christina would be? Like the path that Bobby Christina took?
I mean, that's a hard one because, you know, so much of my feelings around Bobby Chris was, you know, this was a young lady who never had a real chance. You know, the things that she had witnessed. Bobby Brown wrote this really, really sad line in his book, his memoir that came out a few years ago, where, you know, he writes about how him and Whitney truly believed that they were shielding her from all of their stuff. But he also, you know, he writes, he's like, we were so high that we actually thought we were hiding it. Mm. And like, we were not hiding it. And I think about that and how much of an impact that obviously has, you know, on a child. And we obviously ultimately knew it had a great impact, but God, when I think about, you know, if she made it, you know, through, and, you know, if that weekend never happened, you know, where we would have gone. And it's sad because it's sort of like, you actually, one, there's no real way of knowing, but also, was there ever really a chance of it becoming anything else?
I wonder about that.
Especially around, I think, you know, Bobby Chris, who sort of had just all of this pain of, you know, of what she had, you know, seen, you know, being a young child, that, you know, I think it would be a struggle for a long time. I have faith that it would have become something else, but, you know, the sad part here is we never will know. But yeah, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it.
It's, yeah, I think about her and I just think, what could she have? It's just such a sad, it's such a tragedy. Like, mm-hmm. her, what she endured and what she saw. I mean, we can only imagine. What, in terms of how Whitney struggled with substance abuse, how do you think, like, what pressures do you think led her to struggle with substance abuse?
Well, my take is kind of unpopular. And
I want to know.
part of it is, you know, a thing that, you know, I write about in the book, which is like, a lot of people like to get high. And it's not groundbreaking. It's not revolutionary. It's not scandalous. It's nothing. Where it becomes scandalous is because, you know, this is a country that Black people are not allowed to get high, period. It has always been criminalized for us using the exact same drugs. I think so much, especially when I was writing the first book on NWA and just like, you know, thinking about our war on drugs era, where you had tanks coming into black neighborhoods, tearing down these houses, you know, locking these people up for years and years and years and years and years over the same drugs these white boys is doing on Wall Street.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that it was getting wall-to-wall news coverage, this is not me saying it's right or wrong to use drugs, because I don't actually care if you get high. I mean, I really don't, because that's your business. But to me, where it was an issue was the difference in treatment and what that created, and the stigma that that then created around black people who got high versus white folks who got high. And we've seen it all the way up to now, where now it can just be the opioid crisis, the heroin crisis, but it had to be the crack epidemic when it was black folks. Absolutely. Even though you have, you know, white folks using the exact same drugs, they were cooking it different and using it differently. But one was seen as this like scandalous, this is just how these people who are in poverty have to live, versus, oh, this is this party drug.
Right.
That, you know, people are rolling up in, you know, the $20 bills after work and just having a little fun, right? You know, and even now, where you look at the coverage is what's happening, especially in middle America, around opioids and heroin, where it's just like, it's nothing but sympathy. It's all rooted in just like, oh my God, it's just so awful that, yes, this is, you know, hurting these small towns,
poor families,
the way it is, yeah, and these poor families have to go through that. But when it was black folks, it was, oh my God, just look at them. Oh, right. They're criminals and they're thugs. And that's the behavior that, again, if it wasn't so rooted in actual racism, then we would have seen differently. We would have seen different resources being deployed. We would see different support being deployed. We would see different money being deployed. We would see in a different way in which, you know, in the criminal system, it would have been.
Oh, absolutely. I wanted to share with this with
all
you.
All of it.
So I used to work as a vocational counselor in a residential treatment facility. And it was so upsetting to me, because I worked with adolescents, and there are a lot of young black men that were there for selling weed.
Yeah.
You know, not in a substance abuse program, right? Like,
right.
They don't need, exactly, to be there.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
they don't need to be in residential. And yeah. Think about it. Like, how many white boys out there are just selling weed to their frat brothers, and they're not in residential?
Yeah. Like, and, you know, in this moment now where it's like, I think it's beautiful that, you know, we are seeing so much like legislation around, you know, cannabis and, you know, decriminalizing it, but just look at what the system has created, and just look at how many black and brown men especially are in prison for weed.
For weed.
While now you can have, you know, all of these like brands who are run by like really cute like white girls, and they can, you know, advertise it to like soccer moms and all this thing, where it's like, holy shit, you know, just a couple years ago, it was, you know, you had...
You're like, wait a second, Nancy Reagan's war on drugs.
and exactly, yeah. But the other part about, especially with Whitney, that I wanted to remind folks, yes, in this book, is that era, and when you think of the, you know, Nancy and her war on drugs and her going to these black neighborhoods and all of it, and what that looked like, and the shame that was introduced around it, where you had, you know, someone who recreationally got high before they were famous.
Right.
Yes, it happened when they were young, but that was the circumstances of, you know, how they grew up, as lots of people. Then you have fame, which then brings you lots of money, which also then brings you access to very delicious drugs, of course.
Right.
So you have that, all of that combined, and that creates this very dangerous cocktail that eventually is going to be an issue for somebody, maybe. And we saw it became an issue.
But
what I thought was so interesting about it, especially, you know, that going back to that Diane Sawyer interview, you know,
right,
where you get a crack is whack in this whole moment, is Whitney and Bobby couldn't understand, as much as they were saying, you know, oh, you know, we're just rock stars and we're partying. And that is true. But they didn't understand that they were black people on national television talking about getting high. And you can name dozens upon dozens of white rock stars who we celebrate them for their drug use and,
right,
like, you know, all of it. you can't name five black artists who have that same kind of praise.
Absolutely. So we're seeing, so in the 80s, we're seeing this like war on drugs. We're seeing Nancy Reagan go into these neighborhoods and like breaking up crack dens or whatever. And then Whitney Houston is like, I like to get high, but then there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and you know, I think, you know, because your question was around pressures, and right. I'm not at all saying that none of those didn't exist, because of course they did. Of course, I mean, we then saw it. We saw what it was for a person who had this gift, who was expected to be able to sing in a particular kind of way forever. And just like all of the things that she was running from, which, you know, she's, I think so much about how the pressure to be Whitney Houston, what that looked like. And we saw that for a very long time, you know, especially later in her career, where if the song or the music or the album didn't perform the same way that, you know, her first three did or whatever, oh, well, you know, it's the way in which she was then talked about and criticized and judged, which then happened time and time and time and time and time and time and time again. I think probably one of the more pivotal moments for me understanding some of the pressures around what she was dealing with is, there's this documentary, and it's called Whitney, Can I Be Me, that came out some years ago, and it was this filmmaker who followed her throughout the entirety of the My Love Is Your Love tour, which is her last big tour. It was like at the peak of her career.
What year was that tour?
This is 1998, 1999. So this is sort of her last big success. Of course, there have been other things after that, but this is the last huge one for her. And, you know, that tour, I think, is really interesting because it's being documented. And the reason that we never saw the footage, because it was supposed to be, you know, she wanted to do this documentary, they ended up having this falling out because the director heard about drug use. And so he wanted to talk to her about it, and she's like, no. And he's like, well, if we don't talk about this thing that is being so widely talked about within your circle, that is of people who are on this tour with you, and talking about some of the challenges that you were having because of it, you know, missing shows, not being able to hit certain notes, needing to, you know, cancel dates, all this stuff, right? Then I don't know if we have a movie. And so, you know, they parted ways. So we then see this footage. Unfortunately, you know, she's been long gone. And I think, you know, what's powerful about it is, because this was supposed to, you know, it's a tour documentary, there's so much of this footage. So we get to see her and Robin and Bobby and her mother, and just, you know, also the beauty of like Whitney Houston rehearsing like for her tour. And, you know, My Love Is Your Love is like one of her greatest albums.
That must have been, I mean, that footage must be amazing to see.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible, but it's also really, really devastating. And there is this moment before a show. Now, mind you, you know, 98, you know, Bobby Christina is a child, but she is sharing her mom with the world, because her mom is a touring, she's a global superstar. So you can see these really quietly devastating moments of like Bobby Christina wanting more time with her mom, and really only being able to get it, you know, when either she's brought out on stage or, you know, when they're backstage. But it's not like an all day, I can hang out with my mom and, you know, have her all day.
Yeah,
mom,
because her attention is, yeah, it's diverted.
Yeah, she's, yeah, it's diverted. But there is this scene before a show, and Whitney is, you know, she's you know, the dressing room, and she's, you know, sitting at the vanity, and of course, you know, all the lights are around. She's doing her makeup, and she's trying to find Whitney. Mm-hmm. And she's saying it. She's like, I'm trying to find her. And she's looking in the mirror, and she's like, you know, where are you? You know, Earth to Whitney. And I just think of that moment like that, you know, and just how sad.
That's heartbreaking.
You know, and it's heartbreaking, yeah, because, you know, you think about, you know, outside of that dressing room is 10,000 people in an arena ready to see Whitney Houston. They want a good show. Not a single one of those people care that you have a hard day or care that you don't actually want to come do this. They paid to come see you sing, and that's what they want. And I think we don't have enough of a real, I mean, we do now, but we didn't always have these conversations around our expectations of our artists and how, you know, we consume their art, but we're also consuming them as people.
Absolutely.
And we have such a hard conversation around it because it requires us to do this hard emotional labor of, okay, well, you know, have I been that person that's like, I saw somebody that I really loved at a restaurant, they were eating with their family, and I just really wanted a photo, mm-hmm. and I went over and I asked them and they said no, and now I hate them, or now I have an attitude, or now, or I went and I dared say the thing of, you know, well, I pay your bills, you know, and all these things that we've seen celebrities, we've seen this treatment of them by their fans, right?
Right.
But just that idea of you, because I bought your CD or a ticket to your movie or a ticket to your concert, that you owe me
right.
more than that.
If that I have some sort of ownership over you.
I have some ownership. If I see you at the airport, you owe me this photo real quick. If I see you out eating, you owe me this. I have seen people, I've been in this industry for a long time, I've seen people go up to somebody in the bathroom.
Are you serious?
In the bathroom and ask for the photo.
That is so insane to me.
And it's like a person is standing there peeing. You know, and it's just like, but then it's also so interesting too, because, you know, now we're in a time, because there is social media and we've all got these phones and we can all, you know, take them out and do the thing where it's like, I've seen so often where people have zero consideration of these people in any of these spaces, you know, and that's why, you know, one thing I lived in LA for 12 years now, and there is a sort of unspoken rule, you know, amongst people who like live here, like, you know, if you see somebody somewhere, like, keep on going, you know what I mean? Like, because yeah. you see celebrities all the time. You see them down the street, you see them at the gas station, you see them wherever.
Yeah, but that's like New York too. You don't bother
it's like
somebody. Or
you don't bother somebody. There's these places where it's unspoken rules, but there's also people who that's not their, you know, daily sort of existence where they know that this happens. And so some people, you know, I get it. You get starstruck, you get excited, you get all the things. But I have been in situations where I've watched folks where it's like, they just want to eat a meal. You know, I can't tell you how many interviews I've done with an artist that we've been at a restaurant or at a bar, and somebody will just come sit right down.
That is like, unbelievable. Oh my God,
I love you so much. Can I just, you know, and it's sad because it's like, you know, it requires, somebody is going to have to tell this person that this is in poor taste. And, you know, you watch their face, but so many times I watch the artist or the celebrity just take the photo or sign the thing because it's easier.
Right, just to get them, just to placate them.
It's easier. It placates them, but it also, if I don't do this, then I might have to see myself on the internet and somebody talking about I ruined their day, or I ruined their kid's birthday because they ran into me at a grocery store and I didn't take this damn photo.
But it's, you know? Yeah, it's dehumanizing though. I feel like
we
dehumanize these people, and it's almost like these are not like, you know, circus monkeys. These are human beings.
Yeah, but what we do is that as we're doing that, as we dehumanize them in those sorts of ways, we then say the thing of, well, this is what you signed up for.
Right.
This is what fame is. This is what it is.
Exactly. And, well, it's also, that's like, that's victim blaming too.
Yeah, and I think about somebody, especially like, you know, the Whitneys and the Britneys and the Mariahs of the world, where, you know, they have these struggles and it's like, oh, well, you know, I mean, well, you're still like rich and famous. Like, it's not that bad. Like, can't you just get over it? You know, there's this way that we diminish, you know, especially as it relates to anything with like mental illness or anything with, especially, I mean, really, really, especially mental illness. But this idea of like, you have no reason to
right.
be depressed.
Exactly.
You have no reason to be unhappy. You have no reason to be sad.
As
you
if,
have no reason to be any of it.
Exactly. As if money can cure depression. As if mm-hmm. money can fix an anxiety disorder, which,
yeah.
or PTSD, or whatever someone is struggling with. And that, I feel like it's such a limited Well, it's just untrue. It's blatantly just untrue. So what would you like people to take away from Didn't We Almost Have It All?
I think honestly what I want people to take away from it is having, you know, we've gotten to a place where we're trying to have different relationships with celebrity, but, you know, I wanted this book to really be a mediation around, you know, how we used to treat celebrities and how we've tried to shift into something different, but also the ways in which we didn't allow a person to show up in the ways in which they wanted to show up. You know, if we question her a little less, or if we were a little, if we were as loud with our, you know, support when she had any struggles as we were with our criticisms of when she had her struggles, then like maybe something would have been differently. But again, I'm not trying to place it all on us, because she was still an adult who made her own decisions and her own choices.
But the media certainly did not help her mental health.
But none of us did, right? It's none of us. And I think that's the thing too, is, you know, and I, you know, especially I like to remind folks, you know, as being a person who was in a newsroom for a lot of years, like the stories that you see are only so popular because you keep reading them. Right. So, you know, that's the thing that people don't understand, is like, why do we only hear these parts of you? And it's like, well, because that's what y'all want to read. Because
you're fucking, you know, reading the National Enquirer in the grocery store.
It's what you're clicking on. Yeah. It's what travels a little bit wider. So you can't be surprised when you look up and all of the coverage of one person is like kind of negative. Well, they've been trending all day and you've been talking about it all day, and it's a negative conversation, so it has to get covered. So
right,
it's gonna
exactly.
be covered now.
If you're picking up the National Enquirer in the grocery store, you're feeding into that sensationalism.
Yeah. Yeah, 1,000%.
So that's where we have to shift the dialogue. Do you feel like things are getting more progressive? Do you feel like we are viewing people more as human beings, or what work do we have to do in that department?
I mean, I think we're trying. I think, you know, just even something as like, you know, what the Free Britney movement accomplished, I think is so great and like shouldn't at all go ignored, because ultimately, you know, her fans felt like something was amiss with what we had been told about her state of mind, but also some of it was common sense. You know, you can't say a person is completely mentally incapable of doing anything for themselves, but then we like can go watch them in Vegas 7 days a week. Well, that doesn't make any sense.
That's,
you know,
that's
what I mean?
Nonsensical,
like,
exactly.
You know, like, yeah, it doesn't matter if she's not singing live. Well, she's still dancing all these routines, and she's still going through it, and she's performing an entire concert. So like very clearly she has her faculties, no?
Right, exactly.
So, you know, for them to see that something was amiss and to start asking questions and to start criticizing it, and it becoming a loud enough conversation that Britney then felt the support, and she then felt empowered to speak out. And then obviously we see where it got to now. I think that is such a perfect example of the work that we're trying to do now. I think the ways in which, you know, people are having a different conversation around Mariah, or having a different conversation around, you know, Whitney, which I, you know, I think because of the book, people are trying, but also some of it too is we've learned more about her and her since she's been gone. You know, we learned more about some of these, you know, sadder parts of her life that now have given us a level of clarity and a higher level of understanding. But, you know, I've done enough interviews about this book to know that people still really just like want to talk about her doing drugs all the time. And so it's like, okay, you know, like there's ways in which like sometimes we don't want to shift away from things, which, you know, again, that's work that we still have to do.
Well, yeah, because drugs are still, we're still sensationalizing getting high. We're still talking about it in that respect. Do you think, I was just thinking about this. What do you think, this is kind of an interesting question. What do you think Whitney would have thought of the Free Britney movement?
I mean, I think she would have been proud to see someone like that get this moment of freedom, but also, it's sad because, like, you know, that freedom was really a person being able to spend their own money that they had earned and, like, being able to make choices for themselves. And so, you know, I do think that, you know, because she was so much of, you know, an auntie in her last years, I think, you know, we would probably have some really, it would have been some funny commentary from Whitney about all of it. I think she would have probably said something really shady if somebody asked her, where it was like, yeah, that baby deserves to be free. She should have been free because, you know, that family was spending her money anyways. You know, so I think, you know, I do think that she would have been proud of something like that. I do think that, you know, if she was around for where we've come in terms of conversations, especially around sexuality, that, you know, maybe we would have gotten, you know, that Robin Roberts interview where she would have, you know, said, oh, I had this experience when I was, you know, 18. And then, you know, I was damn near, like, not destroyed, but, like, people tried to destroy her for that. They just tried to destroy her for that one, you know, situation with a friend that then became, you know, why won't you tell us about your sexuality? So she might have finally had that conversation, only because she felt the freedom to do it because of the time that we have arrived to culturally. But, you know, I ultimately would have hoped that she would have been able to do whatever she wanted.
Well, she does, you know, from what you're saying and the, you know, the code switching, I feel like she had a little bit of an I don't give a fuck attitude.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Do you think that Whitney ultimately was a private person? Like, did she aspire to be a private person, though she was in the public eye?
Yeah, I mean, she told us tons of times she didn't want fame like this. You know, it was inevitable based off of, well, how magical her voice was, but also the lineage that she came from. Like, there just was no way that she wasn't going to be this.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, thank you for having me. Yeah,
I'm so excited to share this with the world because I want people to know more of Whitney's story, and I feel like you're telling it in a balanced way. It's not, you're humanizing her, and that's what we want. So the book is called Didn't We Almost Have It All by Garrett Kennedy.
Yes.
Where can we find it?
Everywhere books are sold.
Fantastic. And where can we find you online?
You can find me at Garrett Kennedy on Twitter, on Instagram, and my website is garrettkennedy.net.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Such a pleasure.